LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Patrick Lipetit, who joins us to discuss his book, The Esoteric Secrets of Surrealism: Origins, Magic, and Secret Societies. Not merely an artistic or literary movement as many believe, the Surrealists rejected the labels of artist and author bestowed upon them by outsiders, accepting instead the titles of magician, alchemist, or witch. Their paintings, poems, and other works were created to seek out unexplored regions of the mind and recover lost psychic and magical powers. They used creative expression as the vehicle to attain what André Breton called the supreme point, the point at which all opposites cease to be perceived as contradictions. This supreme point is found at the heart of all esoteric doctrines and enables communication with higher states of being. Drawing on an extensive range of writings by the Surrealists and those in their circle of influence, Lipetit shows how Surrealism employed mythology, Gnostic principles, tarot, voodoo, and alchemy not simply as reference points, but as significant elements of their ongoing investigations into the fundamental nature of consciousness. He provides many specific examples of esoteric influence among the Surrealists, exploring the relationship between Surrealism and Freemasonry, Martinists, and the Elect Cohen, as well as the Grail Mythos and the Arthurian Brotherhood. Hello and welcome, Patrick, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Patrick. Now, today we're going to be discussing your recent book, which is entitled The Esoteric Secrets of Surrealism. Subtitle is Origins, Magic, and Secret Societies. Before we get started, perhaps you could tell listeners a little bit about your background and your interest in Surrealism.
I am a former scholar of the École Normale Supérieure in France, which is, sort of your Oxbridge. I'm also, it is mentioned on the cover, the back cover of my book, I'm also a member of the Grand Orient de France, which means that I'm a Freemason. And I started being interested in Surrealism about 45 years ago when I discovered first Breton's writings, books. And then I got in touch with a number of surviving Surrealists. And finally, I got in touch with, recently, with the international network of present Surrealists from Canada, Portugal, South America, France, of course.
When did the Surrealists as a movement emerge? Because presumably it wasn't just in one place at one time. So perhaps you could tell us how the movement emerged and who some of the key figures were in the early days.
Well, I think that the movement emerged in Paris, which was at the time, that's to say the beginning of the 20s in France, the sort of intellectual capital of the world. But the members of the first group were coming from all over Europe, at least at the beginning. I mean, there were German, such as Maxence, for instance, or there were Romanian, such as Tristan Tzara. The core at the beginning was made up of Frenchmen, for example, Breton, André Breton, Paul Éluard, Philippe Soupeau, Benjamin Perret, to mention the writers, and then about the painters, Yves Tanguy, Maxence, of course, and people like that, you know. That's the most famous name of the early group, which started not in 1924, but in 1919 with the publication of a magazine called Literature, which meant exactly the contrary, actually, which was not literature, which planned not to be literature. I forgot to mention also among the very important names of the first surrealist, Antonin Artaud, of course.
How did the popular face of surrealism to the general public who don't know anything about it, if they go into an art shop or if they visit a gallery, maybe if they go to the gift shop, they can find some items printed with Salvador Dali. And mm-hmm. I mean, Yves Tanguy, I suppose, is relatively well known, his work, even if people don't know his name. How do the people who are the popular face of surrealism, if I can call it popular, how do they figure in terms of credibility and contribution to what the surrealist movement was trying to do?
Well, surrealism is a perpetual quest for the marvelous, you know, by every mean. Everything was good to just try and find the marvelous in daily life. That's, I mean, what is at the core of surrealism, what was and what is still, because there are still surrealists working. As for Dali, I think that, well, he was a surrealist, undoubtedly, but he was also perverted by the laws of market, let's say.
Yes, I think that's what I was getting at. Now, what we're strongly hinting at here is that surrealism was not merely an art or literary movement. It was much more than that, really. That, in fact, that was just part of its modus operandi, as it were. It was something at its core which was much more profound than that.
Yes, surrealism is only marginally a literary or artistic movement. It's a way of living. Many surrealists, when I talk about surrealists, there are handfuls of surrealists all over the world, you know. There are only small groups everywhere, and small groups changing groups. I mean, the group of the 20s is not the same as the group of the 30s, which is not the same as the group of the 50s. And there is a group in New York in the 40s. There is a group in Reims in the 30s in France. There is a group in Paris, of course. There are groups in Belgium. There are groups in... There are groups in Leeds, in Coimbra, in Portugal, in Amsterdam, in South America. There are groups everywhere, all over the world. And these groups are made up of just handfuls of people. And all of these people are not writers or painters. Some of them are just mere people interested in this way of living. Surrealism is an art of living, you know?
Yes, and it's clear that surrealism was concerned with, in many ways, with the mind, also unexplored regions of the mind, perhaps lost powers that human beings had, arcane connections between the microcosm that is mankind and the greater cosmos. And in this way, it overlaps with, feeds upon many of the great esoteric traditions. And reaching right back to alchemy and ultimately Gnosticism from there.
Yes, they were interested in every form of esotericism, but as a way of getting to the marvelous, you know. Anyway, some of them managed to... Well, some of them became operative alchemists, people going to the oven, you know, and trying to make gold. One of them at least tried to make gold. They were close to Cancelier, for instance, and they were also very interested in Gnostic ideas. Yes, they were, but for the sense of mystery underlying, you know, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an everyday word in English, certainly, that people don't think about. They might go for some dinner and say the dinner was marvelous without really understanding the implication of what they're saying.
Yes, you know, the French word is merveilleux. Might try to translate it by wonderful, perhaps, but I don't think it's. That's why I choose marvelous, because I think they were looking for what is behind reality. That's the meaning of surrealism, you know. for another reality behind reality, and every way to get to this reality behind reality was of interest for them. But I think this is also a Gnostic idea, because the Gnostics thought that we are living in a, and they still think, because there are still Gnostics, they think that we are living in a wrong world, a fake world, a world made by a bad god, and that the real world is behind the borders, the limits of this wrong world, and where is the real god? There are two gods for them. One they call the Demiurge, which is a bad god, and another one. I mean, the surrealists were agnostic in that way. They thought there was another world behind this world, but not a spiritual one, of course, but not connected with any kind of divine of religion, you know?
I've come across this idea many times. You mentioned the Demiurge, the idea that the world, as we understand it and perceive it, is somehow, you know, it's fundamentally flawed, and that somehow the bad god corrupted, you know, the unmanifested by turning it into the manifested.
Yes, that's it exactly. The manifested is somewhat wrong, deceiving, and unsatisfactory, and there is the unmanifested, which is what they are looking for. That's the real aim of surrealism, I think, in my opinion. That's what I try to prove in this book, to show in with this book, you know.
Yes, in the language of surrealism, and it occurs elsewhere, of course, but the language of mirrors and bridges, dreams and visions, it draws out this idea that real life is somehow elsewhere, and that we are actually living in some sort of illusion.
Yes, totally. We are living in some sort of illusion. In that way, surrealism can be connected to Celticism, because this idea of another reality, you know, is very close from the other world of the Celts, you know. That's why we can also connect surrealism to Celticism, which I'm trying to do with some Welsh friends at the moment, such as John Wilson, for instance.
You mentioned Celticism, and of course, surrealism draws upon that, and there was a fascination as well, and that, of course, takes us into the realm of the Arthurian legends and the Grail as some sort of alchemical metaphor.
That's what I'm writing about at the moment. I'm writing a new book about surrealism and Celticism, and I think that the connections are numerous, you know. But late, they were only interested in Celticism at the end of the, well, in the 50s, let's say. In the 50s, they started being interested in Gaelic art and also literature, because of the meeting with a man called Jean Marcal, who was considered as a sort of a specialist of Celticism in France. Although he's contested by many people who say he's writing literature and not history, or he's not a good analyst of Celticism. But this man was a member of the Surrealist group, and he was of the utmost importance for them. And we must never forget that Breton himself was a Breton. He was of Breton origin. He wasn't born in Brittany, but he was of Breton origin. And his grandfather as told him a lot of legends and tales, Breton legends and tales, that's Celtic legends and tales. He was always influenced by them. And there are also some, Julien Gracq, for instance, is also deeply interested in Celticism. And we can find traces of this in all his books, and especially in, of course, Au Château d'Argol, and also things like short story, La Presqu'île, Le Roi Cophetua, short stories, and of course his play Le Roi Pêcheur, which is an allusion to Arthurian myth, indeed. And we must also mention, of course, Leonora Carrington, who was of Celtic origin and who remained faithful to his Celtic origins till the end of just 2 or 3 years ago in Mexico.
Now, one of the interesting aspects about surrealism and indeed other art forms is that sometimes people consider them and don't appreciate the different levels upon which they work. For example, in Surrealist art, we have to consider the importance of symbolism. Mm-hmm. And in the literature or the writings, we have to consider the words as more than simply words. But in both the symbols and the use of language, we get into the realms of what's effectively magic. Because, of course, symbols and words in certain forms are cornerstones of magic. And that was an important part of surrealism as well, I think.
Yes, yes, of course. But never, you must never forget that, as Annie Lebrun told it, you know, words make love. And that's the title of one of her books, you know. And the members of the Surrealist group have always tried to make this idea live and be very, it was very important for them. But when you break the limits of reason, the limits of positivism, then you reach magics. Yes, of course. And that's what they did.
In many instances and in many ways, surrealism was antithetical to clericalism, religion. But it was quite a complex relationship. But equally, as we've been talking about these esoteric traditions, there was also a complex relationship with atheism as well. So perhaps you could say something about surrealism in that sort of complex soup, but that spectrum that goes from, you know, religion through to atheism.
You know, I just received about 2 days ago a book by a surrealist, French surrealist, working at the moment, and a former member of the Paris group, who is called Guy Girard. His book is called Athée. Atheist, you know, and it's a poem, and so we must say and we must admit that the surrealists have always and all of them been against religion, maybe to the exception of Dali at the end of his life, but all of them have been against every form of religion, and they were, the point to know if they were atheists or not is far more complex. They were atheists. They didn't believe in any kind of revealed God, but all of them believed in the sacred.
Yes, and I think that's very important. And in this sense, they were tapping into and upholding ideas in other traditions that in the modern world, religion had somehow become a cipher for forgotten knowledge, that religion had simply bastardized the sacred. It was a watered down remnant of something that people had forgotten.
Yes, and in a way, it was part of what Guénon called tradition, you know, with a capital T. René Guénon is a key figure, you know. He's a key figure of thought at the beginning, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. He's a key figure of the esoteric circles in Paris at the moment, at that part of the 19th and 20th century. And René Guénon, you know, he wrote about what he called tradition, but he gave to tradition, he thought that tradition was connected with the idea of God. The Surrealists thought that Guénon's thought was very important, but without the idea of God. And, you know, René Guénon, man who wrote The Crisis of the Modern World, or also The Symbolism of the Cross, things like that, the esotericism of Tanti. This man was an important thinker for them. Queneau, for instance, remained all his life interested in Guénon's thought. Artaud as well. And Guénon appreciated Artaud's works. In 1953, in his interviews with André Parineau, Breton said, when I look back at the early years of surrealism, I think that the only one who missed us was René Guénon. And Guénon thought that there was only one tradition, a tradition which was common to every religion, for instance, every creed. This religion, this thought, for this tradition for Guénon was the key, you know. I think that the surrealists, especially Artaud, Breton, shared this view, but rid of the idea of God, particularly of a revealed God. That's why they well, the key word for them was the sacred and not the religious, not religion. They were against every form, any form of religion.
Of course, it then would also follow that they would scorn what gets called today scientism, you know, basically science as a form of religion, which in my opinion, it has become in many ways. In the modern age, science has stripped humanity of something profound by denying there's anything beyond our five senses, that there could be anything sacred in the context that we're talking about.
Yes, you know, they were also against science. We must never forget that the Surrealists were intellectually formed. They grew up at the end of the 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, that's just before World War One, which is for me the end of the 19th century, which was the time of positivism, a religion of science. And they didn't like that. They didn't at all, because they thought that this religion of science, this positivism, illustrated by Auguste Comte, for instance, this positivism, they thought it was responsible for the catastrophe of World War One. And they were survivors of World War One, you know. And till the end, they were hostile to science, which was for them a new kind of religion. Even after the war, they wrote something against physicists. There was a leaflet against physicists at the end of the war, because they thought that physicists had just produced another massive destruction weapon, which was the atomic bomb. And they said that it was necessary to destroy laboratories. They were against science. They were not obscurantists, you know, they were not for the Dark Ages in a way, but they were against what science has become.
Yes, basically they were articulating the idea that the remnants of the sacred that are left in religion, the symbolic, the token remnants, have got some nugget of truth, and that science offers us a way to look at the world, the universe, reality, ourselves, that has some kernels of truth. It's a way of learning something, but so each of them, it's a partial picture, and that there's a synthesis here that if we can move towards it, that's got the ultimate kind of veritas, as it were.
Yes, well, I agree with you when you say that they thought there were nuggets or pieces of truth in the religious, or even in what science proposes us, but they thought also that under religious or even scientist guise, these remnants of truth, yes, were meaningless, and they were looking for a new meaning. That's why they wanted to create a new myth, you know. That was their purpose at the end. After World War II, the purpose of Surrealism was, and is still, to create a new myth for the 20th century, and now for the 21st century. Because that's the idea of what we call the great transparent, les grands transparents, which appears in 1943 in the prelegements to a third manifesto by Breton. This is what the aim which was set for the movement at the end of after the end of World War II, a new myth. They wanted to create a new myth, and they still want to create a new. We still want to create a new myth, you know.
You mentioned both world wars actually, but those had a profound effect on Surrealism, I think.
Well, World War One. Well, the Surrealism was created after World War One, and we must never forget that it was created by survivors. World War Two was also very, very important for Surrealism, because I think that it started before the war, of course, but after World War Two, Surrealism is no longer a French movement, no longer a European movement, but it is a movement which has spread all over the world. I mean, you know, the importance of Surrealism, of World War II for Surrealism, can also be measured when you see what happened with what is called abstract expressionism. People like Pollock, Gottlieb, Basiot, Gorky were deeply influenced by the Surrealists in exile in Paris. Masson, for instance, or Breton himself. And so after World War II, Paris is no longer the center of Surrealism. In other words, Breton can die. The movement has grown international without any center, interconnected, like sort of internet, like sort of web, you know. Surrealism is like the web, interconnection of several groups all over the world now. And it was already like that after World War II.
In the book, you allude somewhat to some of the things that these artists would endure in order to produce their art, you know, sort of deprivation of various kinds. I think it's easy for outsiders to look at a lot of surrealist art and say and wonder about the role of some of the cliched things in bohemian communities, like drugs or alcohol or other substance. To what extent did anything like that play a role?
Well, you mean drugs, alcohol, and so on?
Yes.
I mean, you must never forget what Rimbaud had said, you know, in the letter, dans la lettre du voyant. Rimbaud had told that he wanted to come to a dérèglement de tous les sens. They tried to do it. And they were also, again, and I repeat again, the members of the first Surrealist group were all of them survivors. I mean, Masson had been left for dead in a trench. Supor nearly died. Ernst was in the German trench in front of Bousquet, who was aimed and remained maimed, injured, you know, till the end of his life. And all of the Surrealists of the first groups had been through the war, nearly all of them. And nearly all of them had been wounded, hurt, deeply hurt. For instance, when Breton writes Le Discours sur le Peu de Réalité, we must never forget that he was a doctor in a psychiatric asylum for people coming back from the front during World War I. And those people didn't even believe that reality, that the world they lived in was reality. They believed they were sort of insane because of the war, shocked at least. After World War I, these young people, they were 20, 22, something like that after World War I. They wanted to live, they wanted to try everything, they wanted to live as old generation, like, for instance, later will do people from the B generation, you know. They wanted to experience everything they could. And so, well, of course, they tried drugs and they tried alcohol and free sex and so on, you know. But that's not essential for Surrealism. Except for some people at the margin of Surrealism itself, very important people. The members of what is called Le Grand Jeu, I mean René Dommal and Roger Gilbert Lecomte, because they experienced drugs till death, both of them, you know, and they produced wonderful things. I think of Mount Analogous of René Dommal, for instance, which is an exceptional book.
One interesting aspect of this for me is that the Surrealists, of course, their art was seen, their works were published, and they were written about by others, you know, critics and various others. But most of the time, it seems to me, the process behind the art and the effects of it were obscured. I mean, they were there for all to see and experience, but that they weren't. Often that was not the case.
Yes, but you know, they were like Celtic heroes. On Samhain, what is Halloween now, the Celtic hero used to go in the underworld, in the other world, and bring back treasures and things like that. And that's what the Sures did. They went to the other world, that's to say the unconscious, and they brought back from the unconscious treasures. Those treasures may be of artistic interest, of literary interest, sometimes, not always. Now, these findings, things they brought back from the other world, the underworld, if you prefer, are in museums, but that was not their purpose. Not at all, not at the beginning. Well, I mean, that's what art galleries and owners and literary critics have done with what they did. But it was not their purpose at the beginning. They wanted to explore the other side of the soul, of the mind. They wanted to explore the other side of reality, not make works of art, whatever.
Yes, I think that's one of the aspects of the poverty of the business aspect taken to art these days. Well, it has been for a long time. The question when someone tries to get a book published or wants to find a patron for his art, or a musician wants to release a record, the question for potential backers is, who do we sell this to? Not, you know, is it important to help this come into being?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, most of them, I mean, those people who are now in museums and whose works are selling at tremendous prices and incredible prices. People remember, for instance, Yves Tanguy, which is now, you mentioned his name earlier, Yves Tanguy, which is very popular now in the States, which is a major surrealist artist. Before World War One, Jacques Herold, another surrealist painter, recalls that Yves Tanguy and him sometimes had nothing to eat they just had a glass of wine for a meal, you know, nothing else, because they were poor. Max Ernst as well was poor. So they were, some of them survived, Max Ernst for instance, and later Yves Tanguy, because of their wives or their patrons. You know, the importance of patrons has to be mentioned here. And people like Les Noailles, the Viscount de Noailles and his wife, people like Edward James, people like Nancy Connard, people like Peggy Guggenheim have to be mentioned, because they gave money, they helped to some of these surrealist writers and painters, and they helped them to make their works, to create, you know. That's important. That's very important. That has to be underlined, the importance of those people. Edward James, for instance, Leonora Carrington, wouldn't be Leonora Carrington without Edward James. Les Noailles, the Viscount of Noailles, subsidies some of Buñuel's films, you know, and subsidized, gave money to Buñuel for his film L'Âge d'Or. Nancy Connard had Aragon. That's very, very important. That has to be underlined.
Reading your book, I was impressed by how many pamphlets and journals and periodicals that the surrealists were publishing. Who were the readers? I mean, were they publishing to each other? Or how did these publications become circulated, particularly in the early days when you didn't have magazine stores, for example, and distribution networks?
Well, it's difficult to answer this question. I mean, they were not writing for each other. They were not writing for themselves. There was a network, but, you know, it was a time of literature. It was a time of magazines. It was common at that time to publish a magazine which was only to last 2, 3, 4 issues and then disappear, and another one would be created later. Sometimes bookshops produced magazines, and you could find them in the network of bookshops, and the bookshops was far more numerous than now, you know. That's the secret of it, The distribution network was through library bookshops, and bookshops were really far more numerous than now. And also of course, by subscriptions, they would have lists of people who, all over the world, who wanted to buy them and to read them. Don't forget that in the 20s, in the and even 30s, and even beginning of the 50s, French was an international language, and the French culture was known all over the world. I mean, people in Romania would subscribe for surrealist French publications, you know.
I wonder, just thinking, because I like sort of hoarding books myself, is there a market in these things? I mean, are they quite collectible? I mean, I wonder how many still exist.
Well, yes, there is a market. It's very much the same as for surrealist art or surrealist manuscripts. There is a market, and it's pretty difficult to find the real collections. I mean, the genuine collections. Some of them have been republished. Jean-Michel Place, for instance, in France, republished the collection of La Révolution Surréaliste and Le Surréalisme au Service de la Révolution, and also Le Grand Jeu. They were republished. But for example, the magazines of the which were published after World War II, for instance, BF, L'Archibra, Medium, all these magazines are very difficult to find. And I came across a collection, complete collection of BF, which was a surrealist collection of the 50s just fortnight ago. And it was €180 for the complete collection, 11 issues, you know, €180.
That doesn't sound terribly expensive, actually.
No, it's not terribly expensive, but I mean, every copy of BF is 4 pages.
Ah.
So €180 for 44 pages.
Talking about surrealism and the cinema in the sort of during the 20th century, to what extent did surrealism make any meaningful forays into cinema? Because obviously there are some movies that you could cite as surrealistic without actually having dealing with, you know, core themes in an authentic way. I'm just wondering how much these ideas managed to penetrate the movies in a meaningful way.
Well, I think that there are not many real genuine surrealist filmmakers, you know, except maybe Germaine Dulac or La Coquille, Le Clergyman, or people like, of course, Buñuel. Buñuel is the genuine surrealist filmmaker. But I think, in a way, surrealism has been seminal. For example, for me, people like Peter Greenaway have something to do with surrealist ideas and surrealist way of constructing films. And also, we must never forget that surrealism is not only what was produced in France. There is another major in Europe, there is another major filmmaker which is not well known from mainstream, you know, which is not very, very famous. This man is a Czech, and he's called Jan Švankmajer. And Jan Švankmajer is a very, very, very important filmmaker, and also, he produced, even under communism, he produced about maybe 30 films, surrealist films, which are incredibly inventive, incredibly interesting. But surrealism was seminal in a way, but was not the favorite medium of the surrealists, in my opinion.
Now, we've already touched upon how there were other areas, art forms and disciplines that the surrealists were attracted to and that were influenced by, and that in some cases, which they in turn influenced themselves. And one particular section in your book, which I particularly enjoyed, was talking about Gothic literature, in particular castles, and because it's something that fascinated me when I was a child, was going to ruined castles, and as a whole, it seemed to somehow affect your imagination. And we think of all the dark worlds of, you mentioned some of these in the book, Desaad, you know, Dracula, which of course then became Nosferatu, Elizabeth Bathory, Gilles de Rais, and it was interesting for me how the surrealists resonated with some of the ideas in Gothic literature.
Well, I think that this a sense of mystery, a sense of the wonder again, which is at the core of their interest for the Gothic novel. They were fascinated. They wrote quite a number of things about Gothic literature, and sometimes they wrote Gothic novels themselves. I mean, if you think, for instance, of André Pierre de Mandiargues with his L'Anglais dans le Château Fermé, which was published in 1953 under a false name, under a pseudonym. He writes a Gothic novel, he writes a Salian novel. And I mean, Ithel Colquhoun, for instance, when she writes The Goose of Hermogenes, Ithel Colquhoun from, who lived in Britain, who lived in Cornwall, she wrote a Gothic novel which is called The Goose of Hermogenes, you know. So they sometimes wrote four words, they edited and published, of course. And they wrote Gothic novels. They were interested, a sense of wonder, that's it, you know, a sense of the weird as well. They were fascinated. In a way, we may also say that Un balcon en forêt by Julien Gracq, which is a very, very, very important novel, is a Gothic novel. That's why Breton was interested in it. It was published in 1938, and it was Julien Gracq's first novel. And immediately, Breton got in touch with him to meet him because he thought that this novel was a surrealist novel. And Au Château d'Argol is undoubtedly Gothic novel features. But there was also another surrealist which was discovered by Breton in the 50s or end of the 40s, I don't remember exactly. A man who was called Maurice Fouret. He was a very old man at the time. He was 70, and he started writing when he was 70. And he wrote, for instance, a book which is called Tête de Nègre. And Tête de Nègre is also a Gothic novel. They were not exactly influenced by the Gothic novel. They knew it. Artaud knew the monk, for instance, by Lewis. They knew Gothic novels. They had read Gothic novels. They had read Beckford. They had read Rees. They had read those writers. But they had been impressed by the sense of wonder, the sense of mystery, the fantastic aspect of this. But we must never confuse in surrealist art, fantastic art, and the weird, which is the weird is what is of some interest for the surrealist, not fantastic.
As we begin to bring things to a close today, Patrick, I think that it's interesting, certainly to me anyway, considering surrealism in the context of the links between the material and non-material, and what science, for all its flaws, is beginning to tell us today, which is beginning to ironically reinforce some of the ideas that are inherent to some of these esoteric traditions.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think that in a way, the surrealists were interested in thought, in thinkers, in people like Uspensky, for instance, whose theories at the time, I mean, Uspensky was one of Gurdjieff's disciples, and his theories were quite strange, quite weird at the time when they were published in the 40s. And these men were forecasting what modern physicists are saying, you know.
In closing, what can we say then about surrealism today? What's your take on where we are, who the interesting surrealists are, where the movement has where it has come in the early part of the 21st century, where perhaps you think it's headed, what it can contribute. Can it contribute more as we move forward?
Oh, yes. I think that surrealism at the moment is, you know, surrealism is no longer organized around the central... For till his death in 1966, Breton was more or less the center of the movement. I mean, Breton's writing were read and interpreted by surrealists all over the world. After Breton's death and after the self-suicide, well, the suicide, the self-destruction of the Paris group in 1969, you know, there was no longer any center. There is no longer any center, but there are still groups working all over the world. And even in France, we don't know everything about them. I mean, I just discovered recently the importance of surrealism in North America. You know, in Canada and in the States. I knew, of course, about the Chicago group, which was created in 1966 by Franklin and Penelope Rosemont. But apparently there were groups also in Canada, in Quebec, and there are still groups in Canada, in Quebec, in on the Pacific coast also of Canada, and the West Coast. And there are also important groups in California. We don't know much about that in France. But there are groups working all over the world. And these groups are, as I said earlier, are interconnected, you know. For me, for instance, I was, I went to meet the Coimbra group, I mean, the Portuguese group, which is called a Section Portuguesa, the Portuguese section, the Cabo Mondego section of Portuguese surrealism, which is based in Coimbra in Portugal. I went to meet them last summer. And the summer before, the man who was there was Alan Grober, who is an American, and David Cotter, who were from America, you know. So... we go and meet each other, we correspond with each other, and we exchange, and we make, I mean, John Wilson, for instance, has just published, who is from Wales, has just published a book about Alice, not in Wonderland, but Through the Mirror. And this Alice is a collection of collage with contributions from all over the world, all over Europe at least, you know. So they publish surrealist at the moment, surrealist now published things from all over the world. They meet each other. They publish things together. I mean, the movement is still alive and well.
Excellent. Well, today, Patrick, we've been talking, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, your new book, which is called The Esoteric Secrets of Surrealism, Origins, Magic and Secret Societies. Perhaps before we go, you'd like to tell listeners about where they can find out more about your work. Perhaps you've got a website, and I don't know if there's any particular resources online for surrealism that if people were interested, they could perhaps visit.
Oh, no, I don't have any website, not now, not yet, but I'm going to plan to have one soon, because, I mean, this book, The Esoteric Secrets of Surrealism, enabled me to get in touch with a number of people from all over the world. Sometimes difficult to find my own books for the other books. I mean, this one is widely distributed, and I think it's not too difficult to find in the English-speaking world. But even in France, even my book, the French version of my book, is difficult to find in France. And the other books are also very difficult because they are published by small publishers connected with surrealism. And I mean, I think you may find some things in if you go on Amazon, but not much. I'm not a public man, you know.
Well, I guess if someone wants to correspond with you, they can contact your publisher.
Oh, yes, of course, and with pleasure. So that's another matter, that's another question, yes. I would eagerly answer any letter or any question.
Wonderful. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for spending time with us today on legalizefreedom.com.
Okay, bye. Thank you, Greg. Bye.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's legalizefreedom.com, legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programmes offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.